This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
You describe this as a love story, and a lot of the promotion for the film is pushing the fact it's a love story. Yet it's not what audiences expect usually when they hear love story.
It's an Aboriginal story, an Indigenous story from Central Australia, and for for an audience to watch this film, what's the best way to see a film about teenagers living in an Aboriginal community, but through love? Because love, absolutely, there's no barriers, there's no walls. Mm. It's not black and white. It's not male or female. Love works. Absolutely across the board. It's it's soul rather than issues or anything like that there. So as far as getting a film about my kids in Alice Springs out there to a wider audience, I think love is the best place to set it.
Okay, is that where you're from originally, Alice Springs and the surrounds?
Alice Springs, born and bred, and I live there still today.
So. Okay, and all the film was obviously shot on location.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't imagine how else you would get those incredible visuals.
Yeah, we went to LA and the whole thing was done in a studio.
Still did a massive post-production house. And if you look closely, Nicolas Cage is in there somewhere.
Yeah, he does a cameo as Gonzo.
Now, speaking of Gonzo, this is a character who appears as sort of, he's a significant supporting character. He appears in, about half an hour of the film. He's an alcoholic homeless man. Mm-hmm. Now, he's based on your brother, mm-hmm. and your brother plays him in the film.
Yes.
And what was that like, writing this very challenging part that's based on somebody who's incredibly close to you and then directing this same guy in the film?
The journey of Gonzo in my head has been a sort of long and arduous one. Mm-hmm. Gonzo has this sort of slight, he is, in a sense, the audience. Not a homeless audience, but he's a wine-drinking, sort of human being, and he's trying to break down all those stereotypical ideas of sort of a parkie, as well as he sort of represents all us sort of beer and wine drinkers who sort of frown upon the other drug users in the world.
There is that great scene in the film where he turns to Samson and tells him off for sniffing glue, petrol, tells him off for sniffing petrol, and then he takes a huge swig of wine from the cask.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So there's that sort of stuff. But it all started out, the idea of Gonzo was when my brother, I've been making films for quite a long time now, but not, this is my first feature.
Your first feature, you have done a lot of short films.
Yeah, a lot of short films and a lot of documentaries, and I've shot a fair few features as well for other people. Mm-hmm. But my brother had always said to me, and my brother's, he's been an alcoholic for most of his life, and he is a sort of a pretty well a parky, and he's homeless, quite often, mm-hmm. except for winter when he moves in, moves back in.
And park is that expression for these guys who live out
in a park, street, in a lane. In Alice Springs, in the Northern Territory, they're called long grasses.
Okay.
And that's because where the long grass is where they live, where they can hide. Okay. And basically, he said, when are you going to give me a role in one of your films? He's been doing that for years and years and years. So, the character Gonzo arised in the film, and I thought, right, well, this is an opportunity for my brother, Scott, to be actually in the film, because he can play the part. And I actually wrote it, on the basis of what I know about my brother. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it is that I said, right, well, if you want this part, you're going to have to go to rehab, because I'm not having you drunk on my set. Mm. It's that simple. You have to go to rehab. You have to sober up. You have to sort yourself out. And, if you do a really good job, there's a career in this for you, brother, And he reckoned, all right. And five rehabs later, he lasted 2 days in the first rehab, and then he lasted a week in the second rehab, and he lasted 2 weeks in the third. It kept going until he finally finished his sort of course, in a sense. And he came out, and basically, we were shooting, and he was in Cairns, and he flew flew straight into Alice Springs, straight out of rehab, straight into Alice Springs, and then the next day he was basically on set.
And he did it. That's a wonderful story. All your actors are non-professional, is that right? Am I saying all of them? And all of them give these remarkable, sort of authentic and genuine performances. What was that your reason for choosing non-professional actors?
Because they would.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with complete, absolute, consummate actors who've done 50 films and that, but to take them to Alice Springs would have been a 3-week intensive workshop to mould them into community people and to build, it's so much easier and so much stronger to actually get people from the community to be in the films because they own these stories. You know, they've seen and absolutely have lived these lives.
Mm.
And that's the perfect actor.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something Ken Loach does a lot, and he gets a similar feel in his films, I think, that you're not watching actors who are acting really well. You're watching people who are these parts, who are owning the stories.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the other actors, because we haven't touched on the leads yet, who are, of course, are the strongest part of this film, I think. Samson is remarkable. I might be totally off the mark here, but is it just me, or does he have a certain physicality and energy that evokes a young Heath Ledger?
I thought he was more like Charlie Chaplin.
Charlie, well, he has got that kind of prankster thing to him, but there was something about at the end of the film, there was a particular look he gave the camera and a particular kind of intensity in his eyes that sort of ran a bit of a shiver down my spine, and I thought,
wow,
there's that thing that Heath Ledger did so beautifully.
Rowan's an incredibly special human being in his own, even not playing Samson in the film, he just has this incredible energy and this incredible just vibe.
Mm.
You know, it's almost like when you're around him, you want to be naughty and run amok.
He's that kind of guy.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because he is wiry and you know, he's quite sporadic and
he's very cheeky and
incredibly
charming.
Cheeky and charming and you just want to be a part of that. He's being around him.
And he's also one of those kids. He's just a natural actor, and he's spent his life getting out of trouble by acting his way out of situations or into situations. And when we first met him and he first, came in and met us to consider being in the film, he did the biggest acting job on us. And when we look back now at that casting tape, that's not Rowan that we met. That's Rowan acting the actor to get the job. Like, he's really smart and he's just been practicing acting his whole life.
Yeah,
and he loved it. Like, it's probably the first thing that he's been really good at and that he's got rewarded for all that sort of cheekiness and energy and everything that he's naturally got. So he had a really great time making the film.
Also, he has some very difficult things to do in this film. He is a habitual petrol sniffer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that he'd encountered before in his life? Had he seen other people doing that? Absolutely.
I talked to him about sniffers and that sort of stuff, and he said, I've seen them, in his community, and he's watched them,
And even on the streets of Alice Springs, you don't have to go very far to see that on the streets.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is, and so we didn't do hardly any workshopping of that idea because
he'd seen it.
He'd seen it and he knew how to play it, you know? Yeah.
And look, this is remarkable as well that you've portrayed this so just, it's not sensationalised, but it's just there. It's in this film as a reality of this is part of this kid's everyday life. That must have been intentional.
Absolutely. This film isn't the Doors version of drug abuse with psychedelic anything. It's something that we didn't want to portray or to manipulate in a sense.
Or to even really draw attention to.
Yeah, it's life in a sense, and whether it's it's interesting. The film can be translated to probably any street in Melbourne, let alone an Aboriginal community, as far as the the sort of drug use and issues of sort of abuse and starvation and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's sort of worldly in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what about, let's talk about the other lead actor, the absolutely sort of mesmerising Marissa Gibson, who plays Delilah. What was it? I mean, I can probably guess this, but what was it about her that made you said, yes, she's the one?
It was interesting because, you know, as soon as Rowan walked in, you know, he was this sort of wiry footballer with a sort of an absolute edge.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were looking for with Delilah was this an inbuilt strength and a woman who'd be able to look you in the eye and kill you, you know, that kind of idea.
So I thought it's that look she gives. There's something in her eyes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this inner strength. We needed, yeah. You know, we needed this inner strength because in the film she needs that inner strength. And sort of we looked at a lot of girls, but actually, one of the first girls we looked at was Marissa, and then we completely did this full circle back to her, realizing that she is absolutely perfect.
Now, her actual grandmother... Mm-hmm. Played her grandmother in the film, am I right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Yeah, Mitchell Lee Gibson. Yeah.
Why did you choose to do that? Did she just happen to be the perfect actor?
It was fate. I think it was fate because the funny thing was that Mitchell Lee, as the grandmother, when I wrote the film, she was playing the grandmother because I'd worked with Mitchell Lee before.
Oh, okay. So you knew her already?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it just happened that Marissa was the ideal.
Yeah, it was her real... that was her real grandma.
We actually made a short film called Nana.
That was the thing you did before this?
Yeah, yep. And Mitchell Lee plays Nana in the film Nana. And the little girl that plays her granddaughter in Nana is actually Marissa's younger sister.
Oh, right, okay.
Which was just sort of purely... coincidental that it worked out that way.
Oh, look, she's a gorgeous performer. That scene where she's teasing Delilah about Samson and just keeps laughing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a hilarious scene, and I got the impression that you just left the camera on and just stood back and said, go with it.
Mitchell does whatever she wants.
I got that vibe, and God,
absolutely.
It worked.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, we'd load big 1,000-foot magazines of film and just roll and roll and roll. And it was interesting that, because, you know, English is Mitchell Lee's sixth language. You know, it's sort of, it's off in the ether and she can't speak English very well.
Okay.
So, you know, and Marissa, because, you know, Marissa speaks, you know, English is Marissa's third language, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know? So the other languages are indigenous languages.
Yeah,
yep.
As well as Marissa speaks Japanese. Yeah, quite fluently as well.
Of course
yeah,
she would.
Of course she does.
Oh my goodness.
And so Marissa sort of in a scene like that becomes co-director and sort of is actually talking to Mitchell Lee in language and sort of prompting her as well. You know, and you know, I'm understanding little bits of what she's saying, but actually not getting the complete piece of dialogue she's saying. So it's just rolling. And Mitchell Lee's kind of, you know, Mitchell Lee's doing things like saying, no, Delilah, he's not for you, he's for me. and Marissa's going, no, you've got to say he's for me. No, he's for me, she's saying, you know, the crazy.
She's very cheeky.
Yeah.
Are we going to get some of those outtakes on the DVD?
Well, actually, Beck Cole, who's Warwick's partner, and I are making a documentary about the making of the film through the eyes of Marissa and Rowan.
Fantastic.
Play the lead roles, which is going to be on the ABC later on this year. So a lot of that stuff, the sort of backstory stuff, will be in the documentary with a lot of outtakes of Nana being naughty.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that then.
My hope is that as many people in Australia as possible see the film and want to see the film. That's kind of the most important thing to us, is that, you know, it's a film that we've made for Australian audiences to see. And, you know, there's sort of no way of anticipating what people are going to make of it. You just kind of make this film and put a whole lot of love and care into it and put it out into the world and you know, hope that people find that connection to it. But we did, the film premiered at the Adelaide Film Festival, and we won the Audience Award And we were like, oh, wow.
Yeah, well, Word from Adelaide is good. And
yeah.
And that festival is really important to Australian filmmaking.
Yeah, and they were investors in the film through their investment fund. And so that was our world premiere. And that was really exciting for us because it's, you know, it is a tough film in lots of ways. And but I think people who have seen it so far are really engaging with it emotionally, and it takes people on a journey, and I think that's all people want when they go to the cinema. And I also think it's a film that is the sort of film that you want to see in, you know, it's a cinematic film.
It's a very cinematic film.
And it's a film that you want to go and see in a dark room with other people on a big screen. It's definitely a cinema experience. So,
and for most Australians, it's looking at an aspect of Australia, both socially and in terms of the environment, that I think a lot of Australians don't see.
Yeah, and otherwise wouldn't get the privilege to go and see, you know, without a film like this, it's very difficult to access that sort of world.
And you know, I truly believe that audiences will make their mind up, and, you know, if they come and see the film, they'll take away from that film very diverse points of view. But I think if you come and see this film, you'll actually you'll walk out of that cinema a slightly better human being, which is, you know, a big call. But, you know, this is what cinema does, and this is kind of what this is why we make films. And I think this is truthful in that sense, that if you do come and watch the film, you will be a better human being, which is really big call, but, you know, that's life.
Were you trying to deliberately have a film with very little dialogue, or did it just work that way?
It all came from the basis of it being a teenage love story. Mm-hmm. I've watched, for me personally, I've watched way too many films where 13-year-old girls and boys are talking about love like they've gone through 5 marriages and 17 children.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's just, you know, and when I was a kid and I sort of was really falling in love with someone, there's no way I could talk like that there. I'd throw rocks at them to get their attention and grunt. You know, that's how it's truthful to me. So, and, you know, the first 2 girlfriends or 3 girlfriends I ever had, you held their hand, you know what I mean? You didn't actually talk, you know, sort of. You couldn't, you know, it was just too emotional, and, you know, because if you opened your bloody mouth, you might say something stupid, so you didn't say anything, and, you know, so that's teenage love. That's how I grew up, so that's how I wrote this film. So it all came from that basis of love, and how it's unbelievably hard to articulate.
Yeah, sure.
It's unbelievably hard to articulate when you know, my age now, let alone when you're 14 and you had all those bloody hormones floating around and bubbling and, you know, electricity in the air.
And that intense fear that you're going to screw up and say the wrong thing. And, of course, that brain freeze.
Yeah.
All those brilliant lines you rehearsed the night before just go nowhere. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure Samson's not rehearsing any lines. He's sort of, you know, his idea of love is a bit sort of Neanderthalic and sort of, you know, and her idea of love is the beautiful Ana Gabriela songs in the film, the Mexican love songs with, you know, violins and, you know, this sort of beautiful voice. And that's the way she sees it. And he sort of sees it as sort of, you know, swags and rocks and.
That brings me to my final question, actually, the importance of music in this film and to Samson and Delilah. I think for me, the key, if I had to pick one scene that sort of was the definitive scene in the film that just made me really sit up and think, wow, I'm in the presence of a great work of filmmaking here, is the scene where Samson is dancing to the music and Delilah turns off her music and watches him.
Yep.
And there's that moment where they both connect through their love of music.
Yeah.
How much is music important to you, and how much did you want to express that in the film?
My whole life is music. When I write, if I'm writing a sad scene, I'll play something sad. You know, it just gets all that emotions happening. And, you know, there's times in my life where, you know, this was the song I was listening to when I was breaking up or getting together, or, you know, or that sort of stuff. So I use that music always in my life, and use it to write and to feel those emotions, those raw emotions that were happening to me in life. So I always love that idea of using music like that. You know, her, because they don't talk. You know, obviously they don't say very much in the film. So, and it was incredibly important for me that if a song came on, those lyrics had to represent their the way they felt at that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, those choices of all those songs, and we call that the sexy dancing scene.
The sexy dancing scene. Well, he shimmies rather nicely. Yeah.
Absolutely. He shimmies very nicely at 48 frames per second.
Well, look, all the best with this film. It opens May the 7th all around Australia at the same time, is it?
Yes.
Coming out?
Yep.
So, folks, you can find that in your cinema. I've been speaking to director and writer Warwick Thornton and producer Kath Shelper. Thank you so much for taking the time in to come into Joy 94.9 and speak with me.
No worries.
Thank you.
Thank you. All the best.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.